I'm gonna start on the assumption that Mr. Martin's going to be here, at least I hope so. This is the Special Committee on Telecommunications. We don't quite have a quorum, I believe we will in a moment. I'm Fred Brown, the chairman. Mr. Phillips is here, the consultants are here. I wonder if the, leaving this chair for Mr. Martin, assuming he shows up, I wonder if, legislative staff that were with us last night would sit up here at the table also. It's greater for Mr. Adams, Mr. Hoppus, Mr. Haugen. And maybe I'll bring to the attention of the people out in the hall that we're getting started. Dave and Dave. And I apologize for the delay. I think everybody's triple scheduled this time, and as a result, we've had a problem. Now, one of the people who is here to talk to us has a later a commitment that will require him to be elsewhere rather soon is Bruce Carlson. He's in the Office of Information Processing and Department Administration, and that impinges on communications to an extent that will probably come out if we can get him to the end of the table and ask Mr. Merritt to start directing questions to him or ask him to make his presentation to us.
Bruce Carlson has responded to my question if he could present his concerns. He is the executive director of the information processing, and his particular program deals with all forms of data information, and we've asked him to come here this morning, and he has 9 o'clock, so he'd like to present his.
Go ahead,
Okay. Okay, thank you very much. The bad news is that the only concern that I am addressing here this morning is data communications, which is only, as we know, a very small part of the total pie of telecommunications. The good news is it's very short. But let me start by giving you a brief idea of what the Office of Information Management is, how it evolved, and what we are doing in the area of data communications at the current time, and what our relationship is to the overall strategy for telecommunications in the state. The Office of Information Management was created as an outgrowth of the Division of Data Processing in the Department of Administration. We've all recognized for years that there's been a very rapid growth in the use of data processing and therefore data communications. That rapid growth has been so substantial as to make it necessary to put emphasis on the day-to-day delivery of data processing and data communication services, and some of the planning and policy issues have been left in the back seat. So a split was made this past year, and a small group was formed within the Department of Administration that would not be constrained by responsibilities for daily operations of the data centers and the data communications networks of the state, but could address itself solely to working with the Advisory Council on Data Processing and the Commissioner of Administration to develop policies and strategic plans for data processing and data communications. What we have seen as an evolution throughout the past several years has been the development of individual islands of mechanization, if you will, in support of the various application systems needs of the departments of government. They have developed along autonomous lines, along departmental lines, along project lines, and the emphasis has been, and to that extent, rightly so, support of the individual application. There are some statewide perspectives that we have failed to take the opportunity to address as these other things have been developed. It remains true that each agency has certain application responsibilities and must have support for those projects. What the interest of the Department of Administration is at this time to try to capitalize on all of the efforts that are underway that involve data processing and data communications, be they at a level of data processing or even in the office in the form of word processing equipment such as I see on the table back here, the display writer, so that these may be tied together to facilitate overall statewide communications. It is the belief that communications is important to each and every one of us, beyond the limits of the particular project that anyone may be working on. It's the exchanging of ideas, sharing of information that is developed in the process of supporting individual applications that is ultimately of most benefit to the state. So where we have seen in the past the development of individual networks for data communications, there are half a dozen of them in existence today. Looking at the budgets from various agencies for the coming year, it looks like there may be as many as 11 separate networks.
Can you give examples of two or three so we get a feeling of what we're talking about?
The networks that I'm speaking of, for example, the University of Alaska has a computer network that's accessible by terminals throughout the state, but it has a different set of operating characteristics, a different protocol than, for example, the AEGIS network that is centered on the...
That's the Alaska Criminal Justice Information.
Yes, it is. That is based upon the computer system that the Department of Administration operates in Anchorage. So that's a different set of terminals, a different set of telecommunications lines and the crosstalk is not very easy between the two. A third one is the major computer installation that we have here in Juneau that supports a number of IBM terminals, and it is not even fully compatible with the AEGIS network in Anchorage.
Of course, to some extent, AEGIS has to have a certain level of security.
Absolutely.
So I suppose it would be a good argument. You wouldn't necessarily want to interconnect with that particular system. But how far are we from being able believe it or not, we have a quorum. I can't believe it, Mr. Martin. Also, for the record, we have Mr. Hammock from the House Minority. Ms. Rader from Representative Adams' staff, Mr. Thomas from Elgin's staff, Mr. Brooks from Mr. Rogers' staff, and we have Representative Philip Martin, and I'm Fred Rowell, Chairman. And this is April 7th, 1981, which I didn't say for the record. How far are we away from a situation where people are going to be communicating commonly within a department or throughout the state by using a computer terminal? The hardware is there. I mean, you can buy it on the shelf now and put it in. And at least I've been of the view that we're probably destroying a lot of trees unnecessarily with interoffice memos upon interoffice memos.
Absolutely.
Upon interoffice memos. How far are we away from doing that? Is there planning to do that now? And system basis, any planning, budgeting, any definite plan that in fiscal year so-and-so the money will be requested, we will do this? What's happening?
Yes, there are some very definite specific steps being taken. I'd like to say that we have a track record with the Office of Information Management of having accomplished these things, but we're brand new, just getting off the ground. Our capital budget request for this coming year, FY82, does include a number of items that involve the reintegration of the data communications networks that exist around the state, an attempt to narrow them down to perhaps as few as two or three instead of 11, so that there will be more interconnectability. In addition, it contains an item for what we're calling a statewide needs assessment of data processing, but it also includes office automation. There's a tremendous proliferation of the use of word processing equipment today, We're seeing it in virtually every department. Three or four systems are being procured each week. And these have the capability to talk point to point between themselves. In other words, if you were an agency in the state and had a field office in Anchorage, Fairbanks, or wherever, you can dial communicate between word processing stations and send memos and letters and so forth back and forth. What we would like to do as a part of this needs assessment is to get an inventory of where all these are and try to provide a cohesive strategy where everyone will be using compatible equipment, whatever that means, such that not only within departments but between departments it will be possible to send correspondence.
Do you have the resources to do that needs assessment and planning now?
Today, no.
You know, have you requested it in your budget?
Yes.
And your budget is in the general government
yes, it is.
Category. Mr. Malone is the chairman then?
Yes, it
for the
is.
House side. Go ahead, if you
Well, that's really the total pitch is that it's communications oriented and we want to see both the data processing spectrum up here and the word processing spectrum included, such and perhaps even voice and graphics and some of these other capabilities that we're exploring, all tied together such that the ability to access each other's information bases and communicate even in letter and memo form would be facilitated.
Now the hardware that you're talking about using is not the, say, the highest and most complicated and expensive level of communication. You're not using something as wide as a TV channel or something. Aren't you talking about using standard telephone line communication?
That's right.
And Mr. Hammond.
Most data lines are a little more sophisticated than standard phone circuit and last and smart meter, but yeah, it's a lot less than TV.
Well,
depending
on how slowly you want to get the information to be transmitted, I suppose you could practically even use a pair of empty cans and a tight string that was a little wet.
That's equivalent to some of the MTS circuits we have available.
I guess that. Do you get circuits that when you're dealing in this area? Do you get circuits from Alaska and from the local telcos that are quiet enough and lacking enough and obscure beeps or something so that you're able to use it without having the system garbage your data?
I think the answer is both yes and no. We certainly get a share of each. And we are constantly improving our ability, especially in the division of data processing, to be able to analyze those circuits and pinpoint where the trouble spots are. It is a team effort. It requires the utility and it requires work on our side to help diagnose and troubleshoot those problems.
But at least for right now, you're not talking about a grandiose scheme that would be having a huge mainframe computer, talk to a huge mainframe computer at a massive speed using something as wide and expensive as a TV channel or something like that.
But I think the first part of what you say is, at least in concept, in our mind, having computers communicate one with the other. The breadth of the band is something that I'm not qualified to speak to, but it's my understanding it's not as broad as a TV channel by any means.
Do you know what admittedly this is not a subcommittee of the Finance Committee, but what is the amount of the additional funding that you've asked for in FY22 that is in that budget request before Mr. Malone's subcommittee, if you remember?
There's about a half a dozen items. I don't have a running total on there.
What ballpark are we talking about? Needs assessment, planning?
It's probably in the neighborhood of $750,000. The needs assessment itself is $200,000. There's a couple of planning items that are in the $300,000 and less range. The aggregate of all of these various pieces is approximately $750,000.
Other questions by members of the committee or legislative staff that are here at the table? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Johnson from EMS, finally, speak to us. I guess you're with us now and also in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Johnson. I'm the coordinator of Emergency Medical Services section with the Department of Health and Social Services. And I have brought with me a brief summary of some of the types of telecommunications needs that we have identified in the Emergency Medical Services Program. However, one, I've listed five types of communications, but one that I left off was the issue that was just discussed here a minute ago, and that's the data, which is something that we're moving into for our management purposes. We are charged with the responsibility of certifying all emergency medical technicians in Alaska, and we're in the process now of putting, we have a computer terminal in our office and hope to have them in our regional offices within a few months so that we can have a better system to keep track of certified people. But if I might just read this, and then if there are questions as I go along, please feel free to stop me. The first, and there's no, I haven't listed these in any priority. The first is citizen access, and in communities with telephone exchanges, we usually like to see 911 systems because they're easier for citizens to remember that number and to dial. There's a number of reasons why 911 is preferable, but hopefully you can get service quicker if you need it. Most major communities in Alaska already have 911 systems. A few communities, such as Juneau, Ketchikan, and the Kenai area, actually Kenai, Nikiski, and Soldotna area to combine, may need some technical assistance and possibly funding to help in developing 911 systems. These systems also provide citizen access to other emergency services such as police, fire, and crisis intervention. Other methods of citizen access which may be investigated further include CB coverage along major highways. And I listed an example as the NHTSA, which stands for National Highway Traffic Safety Administration NEAR program, and that's a citizen monitoring of CB that they set up. Basically, that has some problems in Alaska because we don't have enough citizens in some places, but as many people as we can find to monitor CBs along highway, and we also are training first responders who have what we call emergency trauma training or emergency medical technician training, and have identified a number of those people along highways in Alaska who have trauma kits that can respond initially until an ambulance or some other means of transportation can be available. Second, medical control. This involves communications between field personnel and physicians and nurses, usually in a hospital setting. Most ambulances in Alaska have radio communications capabilities, as do most hospitals. Additional radios are needed as new ambulances are purchased. For highway areas, the main problem is extending EMS and public safety communications to remote rural areas.
May I interpose a question here?
Yeah.
I know that in my area, there's been some really good work done in EMS communications, and that their budget requests that they made of us last year and this year too have been engineered out of Mr. Pierce's shop, Division Communications. Is that the case for your planning with regard to other systems across the state with regard to communications? Because basically they come into our caucus from the Fairbanks area, they make a pitch, and I say, well, who engineered this up? Meaning, is it defensible, you know, if we provide the money? And then I end up finding out that basically that most of the work was done in Division of Communications. Are you using their facilities generally in that way?
Yes, but I think it's fair to say that in most cases the assistance we've gotten from the Division of Communication has been along the highways. When you get away from the highway system...
I guess what I'm talking about is a highway system.
In that case...
the company microwave numbers and so forth, VHF.
Yeah, we have always... for a number of years have worked with the Division of Communications to make sure that when, for example, public safety requests a microwave link or whatever, that EMS is considered along with that.
Mr. Robbins.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Has that been in Southeast? Have you done that too with the plan for public safety microwave?
No.
Why is that?
Number one, I didn't know they were putting a system in Southeast. And number two, Southeast, you're not referring to a continuous highway system, although I understand there. Well, okay. But no, but we should probably.
Go ahead with your presentation.
As state microwave links are established, funding is necessary for tying in EMS frequencies. I just covered that. The State Division of Communications was my next point. Has the technical expertise to plan for and project the cost of these links. And we consider two priority areas being the Parks Highway between Anchorage and Fairbanks and the Alaska Highway from Fairbanks to the border. There's a very large number of accidents and a large number of vehicles traveling to Parks Highway. And as of right now, there are places up around Trapper Creek, Talkeetna, those ambulances. In the summertime, Mr. Roy Davey, who has a cabin in Montana Creek, has a lot of radio gear, relays messages from ambulances to Anchorage. But we would like to see a continuous system up that highway so that we're not depending on a volunteer relay.
He's a retired super tech for the Federal Communications Commission, who's an amateur radio operator for about 55 years, I think. Very fine man.
Third component that we look at is paging. Since most ambulance services in Alaska depend on volunteers, pagers are badly needed. Fourth component is reliable medical communications in remote rural and bush areas, and this is where it gets extremely complicated. Communications in many areas of Alaska are very unreliable. Some villages rely upon high-frequency single-sideband radios, which are not always reliable in high-latitude regions. I understand that most communities over 25 should be getting their satellite systems. I believe that's correct, but as of right now, I know some are still relying on high-frequency radios, particularly in the medical communications. Even those communities with smaller satellite stations may experience periods of several days or more when the communication system does not work. And then, according to some of the advice that I've gotten, solutions to this problem may involve improving the satellite ground station equipment, plus reliable power sources, or alternative communications modes such as VHF systems in some areas. And then the fifth and final major component that we're interested in is the instructional television. Not necessarily final, but new certification regulations for emergency medical technicians require 48 hours of continuing education every 2 years. In addition, public information programs are needed to teach the general public safety and first aid techniques, and other continuing education courses are needed for other EMS-related personnel. The state instructional television network could provide a very cost-effective mechanism for making more EMS training opportunities available to people throughout the state. And I just wanted to bring out that each of our EMS regions has one or more communications consultants or advisors to help determine communication telecommunications needs. And we do pay travel and per diem for these consultants, but most of them are on a volunteer basis. And I would really like to see somebody to turn to in state government who can give us coordinated direction and policy direction, planning direction on a technical level. Because we can depend on our volunteers and they give us a lot of input, but our volunteers I don't think are appropriate for establishing what our state policy should be in solving some of these problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think maybe if things like Executive Order 50 or something of that sort of reorganization of that sort has been attempted several years ago, maybe you would be commonly accustomed to using services that now are just overloaded, and those are the services in the Division of Communications. We've thrown about $30 million at them over the last 5 years, and they haven't added one engineer in that division. And they're spread a little thin. Mark?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Johnson, I have a strong feeling for the EMS, but at the same time, you have to face reality. One of the things I'm concerned about, and I need an answer on with EMS, are you all seem to be shooting for your own independent thing, or is there any coordination being done with others? We know what you need and the weaknesses and all, but is the thrust that you all are going to handle your own thing, you know the needs and so on, or is there going to be a concerted effort with other organizations involved with telecommunications?
Well, I think we have made an effort in that regard, but unfortunately, I'm I have no experts in my office, so the only communications advice I get is from these volunteers who work with the regions, or in some cases, communications experts who are on contract with the Native Health Corporations. But I think the answer is we would really like to work with other agencies. We don't really have a formalized mechanism available to us right now. I mean, I can pick up the phone and call the Division of Communications and we can talk about the highway system. But a lot of these other things, I've talked to a lot of people in state government about these problems. It's just finding the focus as to who the responsible people are that can help us with policies.
Well, and you mentioned policies. But to the policies, as I see it now, if we have so-called expert full-time public employee, an expert, the way I see it around here, we always end up going back to the communities of volunteers to make up those boards and commission who really seem to know what's going on day to day and who end up making policies. So I feel here if you mentioned that you didn't want the volunteers to make up policies, and it's going to be that way anyway. It's going to be a bunch of amateurs, and the biggest bunch of amateurs is legislators. So,
well, really what I'm referring to in that is, I can give you an example. A couple of our communications advisors in the Interior region are extremely frustrated with the unreliability of the satellite system, in particular when it comes to the medical consultation that's needed from the villages. And so they have devised a plan of their own, basically, which says that a VHF system in those places where you don't need a repeater between a village and a sub-regional center, for example, like McGrath, would work better. And actually, last year, the Indian Health Service was successful in getting some rebate money because of the unreliability of the satellite stations that they were paying $1,200 a month per station for a dedicated line. They got a little bit of a rebate, and I may not be exactly correct on all the facts here, but I understand that some of it went to Tanana Chiefs, and Tanana Chiefs used some of it to start setting up an alternative system to test it to see if it would work. Now, that's an area of a policy, in my opinion, where we would agree that there needs to be reliable communications from those points, but whether we would, that the state would see it, you know, that it should look at improving the satellite network so that it is reliable, or to look at an alternative system. And I'm in a somewhat awkward position because, you know, I have people out there who are pushing very strongly for one or the other, and I really don't have a good answer for it.
So in other words, if the would this committee could advocate through the telecommunication policy board to work with the EMS, that would be the best bet. Would you not agree?
Yeah, as long as I knew who I could turn to bring all this information.
I hope that depending on how EO 50 works out, what personnel are chosen to direct those divisions, that some of the kinds of problems he's talking about are going to almost solve themselves. If somebody sitting in another governmental department, as Mr. Johnson does, is concerned with matters that touch on communications, will be able to get a hold of somebody and give him some substantial support, rather than, like he says right now, being able to, sure, he can make a telephone call to an overworked engineer at the Division of Communications. Might be working on one or two projects related to that. Now, one of the things that you mentioned, of course, is something we used to always talk about every year in various telecommunications committees. We haven't done it this year. That is, I haven't lately sat down and looked at a little chart showing me what is the situation of reliability of smaller stations. And I suppose that you brought that up. I guess I'd like to ask Professor Merritt, what have we heard lately about that, if anything?
Nothing.
Or anyone else who's around here in the... there were some substantial improvements occurring in the last couple of years, as we've heard over the last couple of years. That is, the settlement of disputes with a couple of the vendors of hardware that were put into the air stations several years ago. Those settlements have resulted in, well, actually one vendor completely replacing all of the, you know, the major hardware that they provided, and actually redesigning it, and redesigning some basic components for it. That was Microwave Associates, and there was this kind of similar arrangement reached with another vendor. And then allegedly Alascom was substantially improving their maintenance capability by doing things other than having the maintenance people centered in Anchorage and then flying all over the state at tremendous expense and with a great time delay. But what we've heard about that lately, I don't really know. What was the last we've at least heard about Alascom maintenance procedures, model?
Mr. Chairman, they were about a year ago, they were conducting training classes to instruct their technicians in the earth station peculiarities and to improve the response time and maintenance capability of their staff. I haven't heard since that time.
We had indications of substantial improvement in earth station
reliability
around that time.
Reliability of the components, the reliability of the station as a whole had reached a point where it was very clear that the major difficulty was the local power. In other words, the earth station reliability had been raised to the point where the earth station power was the critical item in the stations that were unreliable.
I have a report that Alascom came out with in January of 80 that showed reliability from 78, 79. I believe the average on that was about 80% statewide. And I remember one village on that list, Aquioc, A-K-H-I-O-K, was 12% for the year in 1979, which is pretty poor reliability.
That's true. Can't argue that.
I wonder, maybe we could get some follow-up information from
just
whatever sources on that, because that's something we review every year, and we haven't done that nor asked for that information this year. Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. I don't know, maybe something's happening in the last 15 years, but I can't quite comprehend the emergency-ness of it all as we stand there, as you rely on the goods. For 3 years when I first came up here, I traveled with the Bush with the Public Health Service. And one way or the other, we were able to connect the next village. We were able to call some ways. On the spur of the moment, quite often we were called, because the village just knew that the hotspot team that was called was around someplace. And so we quickly hopped from this village to that village. And I thought the communication was fairly good. A major problem was weather and getting people out or getting people in. At times we did take a snow machine or two to get to the next village. But as far as communication, the old shortwave radio and the linky-dinky telephone and what few were there were working. And I don't know if we put...
Where were you in the sunspot cycle?
The who?
All I know is that...
the shortwave radio was working. Where were you in the 11-year cycle to allow the shortwave to...
Well, we just traveled from village to village for 2 years, and there was a lot of emergency that happened along the way. Now, I don't know how many umpteen millions we're going to throw in to improve it when, you know, when you get a phone call, you get a message on the radio, someone's sick or someone's been shot. As soon as we were able to, we got there. But I don't know, by throwing umpteen millions into now, we're going to improve that.
I don't know if it's...
Once you get the message someone's hurting...
Actually, other people, television has been getting the millions, EMS has been getting the tens and hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, we get excited when we can put 20,000 into a link to extend from Delta to Tok. So, but the answer to your question, you asked in the beginning if something has changed in 15 years. Certainly, something has changed in 15 years. On the 24th, I believe there's supposed to be a meeting between this committee and our state EMS Advisory Council. And at that meeting, if you would ask that same question, you'll get some more interesting answers than I can give you, because there are people out there who give me input about problems where they feel people are dying as a result of lack of communications. But you're right, in many instances, if one communication system doesn't work, there are alternatives. You know, maybe there's an airplane there, or maybe it's something there. Sooner or later, you're going to get out. But the problem is that emergency medical services has come a long way in 15 years, and we need to have people talking to a hospital or to a doctor because of what we call advanced life support medical care, and we're getting people out in the villages now who are trained, they're starting IVs or they're getting into more sophisticated care, and they can utilize those tools if they can get medical advice to help them determine what specifically needs to be done with the patient. And, you know, it's one thing to say, well, this patient's dying and we need to get them out of here and throw them in the back of a plane, and that still happens in this state. But we would prefer to see the system working like we want it to work, where trained personnel get on the radio, get on the telephone, call a hospital, give the vital signs, you know, explain what's happened to the patient, the mechanism of injury or whatever, and to get sophisticated advice as to how to deal with the patient, hopefully stabilizing the patient before transportation. And we feel lives, you know, are saved when that happens. And so, you know, utilizing whatever's available doesn't afford the opportunity to give that kind of medical advice.
Well, we did do that, Mr. Chairman, either call a medical hospital, in a couple of cases called directly to the Anchorage Native Hospital and have a doctor right there.
Well, I understand that, but I think that there are instances where people aren't getting through to the hospital, and that's the concern that we're raising.
Mr. Brooks?
I'd like to address or tell a little story to Representative Martin. 60 miles from Juneau is Tenneke Springs, there. 4 weeks ago, when I was in Tenneke Springs, on a Sunday evening, the major means of communications in Tenneke Springs is an Alascom operated air station. The single telephone that's operated through that air station is at the in the community store. The person that operates the store that Sunday night went out and got drunk. The store was locked up. A 6-month-old baby went into some complication problems. That phone was inaccessible. They went running down to the dock and got on a VHF radio and started screaming for help on VHF channel 26. And the only thing they could contact was a barge going south about 80 miles. They were trying to get an airplane in there to transport that child to Juneau. That baby died that night because that phone was locked up. And that kind of situation exists all over the state. And because of the single mode,
it's a communications management
problem. Yeah, it's a management problem, but also there's no backup, essentially. If that air station was down due to unreliability, and that's one of the things we're trying to do is provide one of the policy problems that we have is we're not allowing for secondary and other alternative backup systems. And we've got to get a primary response in EMS communications out there. Somehow, at least a uniform policy where the state is uniform taken care of.
And how many people live in that area?
There's 159 people living in that community, plus the other logging communities around there. There wasn't a plane that could respond. They couldn't get transport. And when they finally got one, it showed up 3 hours later and the child had died.
The 138 is going to take care of that, isn't it?
No, 138 does not address EMS in any way, shape, or form.
Doesn't address EMS. EMS funding is usually in the budget itself.
And, there is.
And specific requests with regard to the budget.
I have done quite a bit of research in the EMS communications that are in the budget in different systems. There currently is a $6 million capital appropriation item for microwave backbone communications and VHF repeaters throughout Southeast, also from the ties, the Parks Highway, which is lacking between Anchorage, or actually Wasilla and Kiwi, and also from Delta to the border. There's another appropriation, another capital item, which is the Hall Road Communication System, which is another major transportation corridor in the state, which is about $2 million. Plus what EMS, or the governing agency for the backbone communication system, this actually is the link from a mountaintop repeater to the hospital that they want to key an ambulance radio. There's $300,000, which was cut by the governor, reduced to $100,000 under
the highway planning, or the highway safety planning agency, which is a part of the Department of Public Safety.
Let me ask you a question.
These are the ends, that is to the extent of communication monies right there for communications that EMS can address in the budget this year.
Let me ask a question, Mr. Johnson, or whoever else wants to answer it also, and that is that originally EMS actually meant something with regard to a certain originally federally funded and established program, I believe, back in the Stone Age. And is that still the case? Do you have any federal money support at all, or with the current administration, if you have any, is it disappearing, or what's going on?
As of July 1, we will be 100% state funded. Regardless of what administration, we had basically reached the end of our federal eligibility. As a matter of fact, the Carter administration was in the process of phasing out the federal funding for the program, but we are state funded at the moment. And the differences are really not that great as to what our goals are or what the federal goals are, except that we now have a lot more flexibility to address, I'm sure you've heard this before, but the needs of Alaska without looking at the federal requirements. And for example, with the federal requirements, in order to be eligible for grants, would require what they call tracer studies, and they can be very useful. But when Southeast Alaska had to have a staff person spend 2 months working with hospitals to trace highway accident head injuries and found that there were two for the period that they were studying, it was basically a worthless study, but we had to do it because the feds required it. But so now we don't have those kinds of federal mandates, and we can look at our own priorities. So I'd say in general that would be the basic difference between our program, although we are designing our plan quite differently than the federal mandated planning design. We've used the level of care concept that has been adopted for the state health plan, and we've developed a state EMS plan around that concept. And our communication section of the plan basically says who needs to talk to who and why, and we don't really get into the technical aspects of how that should be done.
Professor Brown.
Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, that $6 million that was mentioned is not just for medical, it's for a lot of other services. The medical gets a small channel capacity on that microwave. That $6 million is slightly misleading if you're talking about EMS only, because it's not that.
That's state services, troopers.
That's troopers
and fish and game,
and fish and game, and transportation. Medical is a small portion of that money. I wanted to clear that up. I didn't want to.
I wanted to clear it up myself. They were just trotting
off the $6 million.
What the hell is state troopers doing?
They're the driving force behind that program.
You know, most the direct EMS communication usually gets down to the mobile radios or the pagers or something like that. But as far as the long distance, we usually try to tie into some other system, the public safety system or the telephone system or whoever.
Mr. Martin.
You mentioned before another major thing you'd like to do, and I've seen some real good shows on your training. But here again, I'm worried about if you want to go on your own thing and not complement what others are doing. Do you use UAS or UAA or public TV for your overall program during medical services?
Well, have you really started doing that yet, or is that just something you said you wanted to do?
Well, we're just getting involved in that, but as a matter of fact, the University of Alaska, we have begun working with some of those programs with the university, one being the Sea Grant program, because we have an interest in seeing the deaths due to drowning reduced, and they have an interest, and the Coast Guard has an interest, and so we're beginning to try to develop a coordinated strategy on that particular disease or problem. I think we do have a lot of coordination with other groups and agencies.
I think the concern that's implied by Mr. Martin's question is that if you get into doing training by using telecommunications techniques and ITV, that you don't do
uses their services rather than building their services again somewhere else just for the purposes of producing programs that are instructional television for EMS health aid.
Yeah, but in some instances we may want to, if we have the opportunity, we may want to have programs specifically targeted to those certified people who have to have continuing education for their certification.
That would be instructional.
But in some other instances, we might want to have general informational programs for the public on safety tips or first aid tips or for school children, that sort of thing, if we have that opportunity.
Mr. Hammond?
I was going to observe that I doubt that the EMS will ever have the money that they need to duplicate the ITV system.
Well, I'm doing my best to make sure you don't.
Okay, Ms. Rader, then we're going to have to go to the next piece.
Can I ask you, how many channels for EMS do they have now? I think it's two or three.
Well, they're still using the state FCC approved frequency at 155.160 on VHF. They have their own departmental frequency also. I think it's two or three.
Is that considered adequate, or do they need another channel?
Well, they were complaining a year or so ago that they were having too much traffic on their system, but I think that they worked that out administratively so that they're doing some of their day-to-day management communications on other frequencies. So I've heard that that problem is not as bad as it was. It probably, as Anchorage grows, someday is going to have to go into a UHF system or some others, maybe a 10-channel VHF. I think that's available now, but I don't think that needs to be done yet.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have Jennifer Wilkie and Jane Demmer. You can grab two chairs, and I'll grab the towel. Fellows heard a portion of the presentation last week up in the House Finance Shop, but quite frankly, I was running in and out and doing other things, and I think maybe there's only one or two people here from the legislators or staff that are at the table that heard the whole thing, so I'm not sure how you want to allocate your time, but you got 27 minutes to do as you wish.
We know our limits, and our objective is, my understanding is that you... our intent here is to brief you on what we are doing to fulfill intent from the appropriations of last year and to give you an orientation for the gamut of things we're involved in. And that's correct. And then to entertain questions, and we specifically can address issues that concern the budget as well.
Sure.
I'll begin.
Identify yourselves and so forth.
My name is Jennifer Wilkie. I am the coordinator of instructional television with the Department of Education. And based on HCSSB 165 last year, we have undertaken a very extensive activity, principally with the University of Alaska and the Instructional Telecommunications Consortium, of which Jane is the director, as well as in a tri-agency agreement, the Department of Transportation, Division of Communications for Technical Assistance and Planning, as well as equipment construction. Essentially, to give you an orientation on the significance of the new work we've undertaken, comparatively, since 1977, we have been offering a limited amount of instructional television on the transponder leased by the state during school hours when it wasn't used for anything else. And it operated prior to last year on a budget of between $50,000 and $60,000. A one-person office, limited amount of acquisition, and we're doing our best to gather available materials. The funding from last year upped that funding in our office to $770,000, which has permitted us to undertake the activities that I will now proceed to describe. In case any of you have not seen it, we have issued a publication and are identifying our activities as creation of the Learn Alaska Network. If anyone would like copies of these, we this outlines in more written detail what we will summarize briefly here. In essence, we have, based on the funding received, continued to broadcast on the existing satellite channel this school year. For those of you, I am a visual person and it helps me to see evidence of things, but if any of you are interested in taking a look, we do publish for the schools that now receive the satellite a program guide of what is on the air daily, Monday through Friday, during the school year. And we publish the time schedule in 4 time zones. You will, the gray on the sheet are the college courses, the others are K-12 or general adult education. Certainly, we have quite a few copies of these. Again, this serves now only the sites on the current state satellite network. We have established a very strong liaison with the University of Alaska. This is backed up in policy by the State Board of Education and the Board of Regents, and is perhaps a very unique effort in the fact that both the Commissioner of Education and President Barton at the university are very mutually enthusiastic and supportive of this activity. The schedule that you'll see that we are conducting this year is just an example of what will be extended and increased for the next school year. In addition, I'd like to reiterate comments that were made by Mr. Northrup yesterday on behalf of the Public Broadcasting Commission, that we are endeavoring to work cooperatively with the stations in the state on services that are available to us from them and support that we can offer them. Specifically, some of our programming is being carried here in Juneau on K2, and it provides an uplink to the satellite for state viewing for certain hours of the day. And we have funded that activity as a contributing to the programming that's available for education. In addition, our cooperation with the PBS stations, based on the quality of their proposals, we have 2 contracts with 2 of the stations for various services. We are endeavoring to develop a full outline for our operations that is fully compatible, also taking into account the distinctions between public broadcasting and the specific requirements of instruction for specialized audience.
Boy, we must be awfully unpopular out in the rural areas if, when we video teleconference on Thursdays, we end up preempting Sesame Street.
Mr. Rogers is the one everyone misses the most. We did lose an hour of instructional TV during the session. We heard about that.
Go ahead, if you
all had to love it, Mr.
In policy, then, we are working in a tri-agency agreement. Internally within the Department of Education, the State Board has appointed a policy advisory group, a task force for this year. It consists of those people representing all the various professional associations, NEA, the PTA, the elementary principals, secondary principals, superintendents, students, etc. And the purpose of this is to have both lay and professional educators outside the department advising us on the decisions that we're making in implementing this project. And their directive is to make recommendations to the State Board of Education for continued input from others outside the department and those professionally working in K-12 education. The funding, again, for this year has permitted us to initiate production of Alaska Topic ITV. This is the first time we've been able to do that. We have in the works 4 programs on different families throughout the state. Alaska, we've done this all by competitive bid. All of our successful bidders have been in Alaska producers.
We have paid for this, are we?
Yes. Yes.
I'm impressed with this. I kind of like it.
Great.
This is, it says it's published by KAKM, but I had the impression it was through things like 165 funding. Can you mention a little bit about the money?
That's right. You want me to do it now?
Yeah, you could.
Okay. The other area, in addition to our extensive instructional, is that we've taken a look at the educational potential of commercial television. We put out a request for proposal for the publication of a monthly guide that would tell teachers, parents, or students what had been endorsed by educational agencies that was going to be on commercial TV this month in Alaska.
Are you also include PBS in here.
Yes, correct. The networks as well as PBS. The difficulty being that the delay time within the state can be anywhere from 3 weeks to 8 weeks. So you'll notice that in this publication, which has, by the way, been very successful, we've gotten excellent responses from many parents, the PTA, from NEA, and from many schools. Our subscriptions now, we've been on the stand since January was our first issue. Our subscriptions received are over 3,000. And that is, I guess, higher than I'd expected. We provide teaching materials, ideas for discussion, dates when the show will be on in your community in Alaska.
Mr. Martin has a question.
Thank you, Jim. Jennifer, what I read that and I thought it was very good too, and thank you all for sending your materials to us on a regular basis. Doing long sessions, I find it very. One thing that worried me about this and working with you, one of the complaints by the education establishment used to always be that your kids spend 17,000 hours a year in front of TV, that the teacher is more important to the child's development than the parents because the parents never see them. Yet we see our education institution going more and more for TV, and when I read this, as a teacher that just did it for 1 year, I figured, God, you know, this would be great. We put them in front of this show, put them in front of that show. And I wonder about that potential trend that the kids are going to be end up in front of TV as much at school as they would have at home.
Your point is very well taken, and in my work and in service and discussion with teachers, teachers couldn't agree with you more. There's a perception that there's this conspiracy to convince teachers of the value of television, commercial television in some senses, and they are very skeptical and very critical of it. What we've tried to do consistently, and you'll notice in every issue we have a method section where we take on those questions, and it is completely a personal option in each classroom, and we're not saying that this is to endorse more viewing. We're saying repeatedly that selective viewing, television is not going to go away, and when you consider the fact that on the average children spend more time watching television than they spend in the classroom, then the model that the teacher can be and the model that the parent can be is to be selective. Choose your viewing if you choose to view, and not just sit down and turn it on and watch everything that's on. And so there really are a very finite number of programs that are endorsed or that we consider to be to lead to additional educational activities. There really are not that many. We continue to stress selective viewing. It's a whole new approach to television that you can control. Television and you don't need to watch it just because it's on, just because it's there.
Has the institution, in cooperation with the teachers themselves or the schools, put a minimum? Is there perhaps a safety zone which you say your kid while in class should be subjected to TV viewing no more than 8 hours a week, 12 hours a week? We can almost exclude our teachers. You might say that might be viable.
I don't think there's any danger of that happening, frankly.
I watch everything. I do an hour of this stuff. Go ahead.
It's completely a local decision, and I think what this publication represents is the increasingly strong national trend of groups like the PTA to take television to task in many respects for the content of programming, and all we're simply trying to provide is, it's difficult because in so many communities the broadcast dates are so different from the lower 48, and if you hear about a good program being on, it can be difficult to find it. And so we're trying to simply introduce that whole concept of critical TV viewing, not believing everything you see, choosing what you watch, being more discriminating as a viewer, but it's very much a personal decision.
And the amount of effort that this evidence is rather impressive, just coordinating to make sure that you can get the local broadcast times for these programs, KISW or wherever. And then also, one of the things I really appreciate as one of the few people in Alaska who ever really filed a copyright infringement action on behalf of anyone, I appreciate that you indicate what rights there are available to video record, if any, for each program.
It's one of our most frequent requests from schools is, can I copy this show that's on the air? And we do need to be precise with them. will be publishing 6 issues totally this year. This project, on contract to KAKM, competitively bid, this will cost $78,000. And the response has been terrific. So we are assessing the reader reaction, and we'll make a decision in terms of our funding whether we do continue with this. The broadcasters love it too.
Mr. Otis.
I was wondering, can you give us an idea of what the impact of the time zones differences in that problem we have with that?
With regard to the ITV program, generally?
With regard to ITV scheduling? It makes it virtually impossible to get every program to everybody when they want it. It's very difficult. What we've tried to do is to repeat programming, put it on as much as possible when it hits a reasonable school hour in any time zone. Repeat, and we purchase programming with the right, we pay for the right for any school to record any program, no programming off the air. So there are some restrictions, but we tell them what they are. You may keep this program for 7 days, you may keep this program for the rest of the school year. So we try to mix that capability, and in addition to circulating programming on tape on their request.
We are running a little short of time, Mr. Hammack, and then I'd like to at least get a shot at what Jane also has to say, and maybe we'll even hold past the bells here and keep going for a bit.
So in the foreseeable future, do you anticipate the ability to take away will enable you to deal with the time zone differential? Or do you have any plans for seeking additional channel for ITV in order to get around time zone problems?
Well, that will be part of the network. That was funded last year.
They did that last year, and they have very wisely not bought it when they don't have programming for it yet, in spite of the fact that a rather large company in Alaska tried to sell them satellite space when they didn't have programming ready, and they didn't buy it. Starts August, I believe.
That's our current plan, so that there would be a full educational, non-commercial channel, and construction will begin as soon as we can, spring and summer, for the viewing of this educational DVD channel.
Okay, is this not in the daytime DVD channel will still carry ITV, or
there'll be a transition period, but we anticipate when it's fully functioning, an 18-hour-a-day channel, it's exclusively non-commercial.
Okay. That's probably 83, aren't you talking about?
Well,
by the time all the
gist of my question was that are you planning anywhere in the foreseeable future? Do you have any desire to have more than one channel? Is there a need as you proceed?
Let's just get the first one here. We don't know yet. I would like to.
That's an answer to my question. Okay.
If I may mention very briefly, one other component that's been very vital in our support of local activity. We are conducting productions and pilot productions at the state level that are optionally then to be available in curriculum about Alaska in the schools throughout the state. But one of our most popular activities has been the ability to offer local grants, and we have, as of today, through the total of $850,000 appropriated last year, awarded approximately 24 grants for local projects. Things are happening now, for example, in Bethel, video production about Yupik winter subsistence skills. In Savunga, high school students are spending 2 weeks with the whaling captains, developing from their viewpoint that experience of whaling and hunting. And we have projects like that both in urban areas and in rural areas, and it has been one of the most competitive areas of our activity this year.
Mr. Merritt and then Ms. Demmerich.
I have a short question. I think with what perhaps you were asking too, when the 18 hours of ITV channel is available, and if the TVDP channel is not being used at that particular hour for some commercial program, would you find perhaps you could get around some of your time scheduling by using that channel too, or would that channel be available to you on off hours? seems if it isn't being used at that time, is there any plan for programming for that channel, or does anybody have any idea?
Well, we would be planning to continue to program some daytime now as well as transition is being made.
Yeah.
And then our interactions with RATNET, the advisory committee to the television demonstration project channel, so we see that as, you know, a development that would have to be sort of thought through in concert with that group.
Well, it seems like that might provide some alternative around the time zone difficulties. It also would give you some other options, perhaps.
Go ahead if you will.
I'm Jane Demery, I direct the University of Instructional Telecommunications Consortium. We just got established late in the summer, and our offices are part of the chancellor of the Community College Division. However, we provide service to the entire university system. The service consists of faculty and staff development in uses of available video programming, faculty and staff development to help people to get their skills together to use audio conferencing for instruction. And we're beginning a process of faculty and staff and student development to more effectively use computers to support instruction and learning. The shop that we have is growing. We are integrating the media services function at Anchorage Community College into this university-wide consortium, and this transition will have been completed by June 30th of this year. Our office, in conjunction with the Department of Education's ITV section and the Division of Communications, signed a memorandum of agreement last fall, which Jennifer referred to, and in that memorandum, it was established that the operation center for the new television network and the audio conferencing service would be operated by my shop, the UAITC, the University of Alaska Instructional Telecommunications Consortium. And we're just in the process of getting that established. The Learn
Alaska. Call yourself a consortium. What are you a consortium of?
Of all of the university units, the three four-year campuses, the 10 community colleges, the 8 rural education learning centers, and all of the statewide cooperative extension services.
Do you actually have involvement with all the people who some way or the other are or believe they should be involved with uses of television in the university system?
Yes, that's beginning very, very nicely. We work, for example, with an advisory committee that does have representation from each of the four units of the university. And, for example, on the Fairbanks campus, we have a very active telecommunications committee that then ties in with our statewide group. In Fairbanks right now, we're working very closely with the School of Management, which is headed up by Dr. Bill Phillips, and the School of Engineering, headed up by Dr. Ben working with them on their proposal to deliver outreach instruction beginning as early as next fall in those two fields. And we're doing that same kind of an approach in Anchorage with the School of Nursing at UAA and also with the Associate Degree of Nursing at Anchorage Community College. Our curriculum development, which is another major area of activity, is again a consortium process. We are developing fisheries curriculum with Kodiak Community College advisory program and are developing natural resources management curriculum with a Kellogg project, which is an arm of a project funded to the Cooperative Extension Service. So we are working, yes, literally across the entire university system so that this whole process of development is one in which all of the units of the university are involved. And it's a terrific project trying to work with all of those groups that's vital to this whole process.
Are you anticipating going into, among other uses, using video conferencing as a teaching tool?
Right now, candidly, we are interested in live one-way video. We are most interested in interaction between students and faculty.
Well,
by
one-way
audio
video, two-way audio?
Yes, right.
When are you going to be doing it?
Pardon?
What are you going to be doing? When is there going to be a university class that's really being taught that way?
Next fall. And we have begun the audio conferencing as of last week. We now have 90 audio conferencing site coordinators trained for the new instructional audio conferencing network. We conducted training in Anchorage last week and had 60 participants from approximately 25 communities in the state. And then on last Wednesday and Thursday had concurrent sessions being delivered by audio conferencing so that we were training people in Anchorage and I was in Fairbanks facilitating the training there. So we now have also a whole network of people trained to do that audio conferencing in Anchorage and in Fairbanks. Our first statewide audio conference for instruction was held last Saturday, linking several sites in Anchorage in a human services seminar sponsored by Anchorage Community College by Joe Joyner, linking Galena, where we have a new outreach program in human services, and tying in a resource person who was in Philadelphia attending a national convention. And we see this as literally the point of departure for very comprehensive uses of this two-way interactive communication for adult learning. And what we found in our training was that school districts are very interested in pursuing the uses of audio conferencing, not only for adults, but for kids as well. And it's just really beginning to crank up in terms of linking groups of students together within the state for joint learning projects.
Well, let me lobby with you for a bit. I am strongly of the opinion that instructional television techniques, particularly video teleconferencing, one-way video, two-way audio perhaps, are the kinds of tools that can be used that I think could eventually do away with an awful lot of the harsh factionalism and regionalism in the University of Alaska system, and also can provide an awful lot of services, particularly across the three major campuses, that where now you may find that you have expertise in the public administration field in Juneau, or a very strong music faculty in Fairbanks, or an excellent nursing program in Anchorage, and so forth. So that in those very top instructors in those fields that are at those respective campuses can actually have regular classes that they may be teaching simultaneously in the other two campuses from their own campus, and greatly cutting down perhaps on travel requirements. So they might do, you know, fly to the other community once or twice in a semester, and the rest of the time they'd be working out of their own individual campus. And I think that if we can start doing that and start doing it damn soon, there's going to be a lot less pressure on legislators to advance regional viewpoints with regard to the services of the University of Alaska, and those viewpoints are almost always very destructive.
Can I have 5 minutes to equal time?
I was accusing myself as well as everybody. I'm talking about all regionalism. I can remember longer ago now than I should admit, what, twice a week, you know, John Hilpert? I think that he must have traveled the equivalent to the circumference of the earth teaching courses in engineering management just during the 4 years I was at the University of Alaska, just flying back and forth between Fairbanks and Anchorage. He could have paid for a bloody satellite during the time, just during his teaching career, the amount that he spent on plane, or the university spent on plane tickets for.
And we're beginning to approach that. To date, it has been a matter of travel, but for example, there's a baccalaureate degree in nursing being offered on the Fairbanks campus now in an outreach program from the UAA School of Nursing. So we are beginning to make that transition, and they will be heavy users of the system as of next fall. And we have a petroleum project, an associate degree in petroleum technology out of Kenai Community College, which is a consortium project with Hananau Valley Community College. And they will be using at least the audio network for a large degree of the continued contact that they desperately need between the faculty in Kenai and the students who are now scattered, at least in the interior.
And if I may add, what's also beginning too is our work with people like Mr. Johnson and the potential of the television and two-way audio for EMS instruction and quite a variety of health services. We're getting considerable amount of income
experience I've had in teleconferencing, particularly educational uses, it seems that there's generally a real predisposition for adult education to be amenable to the system. The University of Wisconsin system and others have been very successful dealing with that target group. I do have, I'm curious a bit about a couple of things with the elementary level stuff, the ITV system. My last experience in ITV was on the ETSX project, which a few people in this room may recall. But I'm wondering if you've had any, if you've had much of a problem with the just not turning the
name. What I would like to do right now, because that's the last bell and I have 20 seconds to get upstairs, Mr. Martin's left and so forth, is I'm going to adjourn, but I would, as far as the meeting is concerned, but I know the legislative staff and consultants probably would like to keep talking about some of these matters. So I'm going to leave you all here, and it's no longer going to be the meeting. There's no reason you can't keep talking about these things.
Well, I was just